The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Thank you all for coming. It's great to see so many of you here. We've been working on this event for quite a while, and I think you'll find it very interesting. There'll be time for questions and answers after our guests are finished speaking, so keep that in mind as you listen to their stories. And we're going to get started right away here. So I'm going to introduce Melinda Thompson from Partners for Peace, and she'll introduce our speakers.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity to bring the Jerusalem Women Speak Tour to Professor Abu-Nimer's class, and welcome to all of you. I would like you to meet the three women who have come to us from a long way and arrived yesterday and met each other for the first time when they got here. So I would like you to know that this is the 15th tour, but this is the first time for each one of them, because each time the tour comes, we try to have different women. And so they will tell you their stories. We haven't given them any program or any coaching or anything. They're going to tell you their stories. And Dr. Julia Chaitin is going to be going first. She's a professor in Israel. She lives in Kibbutz Urim in the Negev. And then we'll hear from Lucy Talgia, who's on the end, and she lives in Bethlehem. And then Inas Mukafer, who lives in Jerusalem, East Jerusalem, will speak last, and I hope you will enjoy hearing them, and you'll have time to ask them questions at the end. Thank you.
I'm just going to interrupt here real quick. I just wanted to make a quick announcement before we started. We're very lucky to be recording this event in many ways tonight. We have a photographer, we have video going, and we're also podcasting. So I just wanted to say that up front. If anybody has issues with that, please let me know. But hopefully we'll be able to make use of this event for people who weren't able to be here as a result. Just wanted to say that up front, and now I'll turn it over to you. Thanks.
Hi, everybody. I'm Julia. I'm just going to start by showing you where I live and the kind of area that I'm going to be talking a little bit about in the 10 minutes that I have, because I know it's kind of hard to understand, so I just want to show you where I live.
The Gaza Strip, okay? So I live within Israel, and my kibbutz is right around here. And here we have Sderot. Sderot is the town that gets a lot of Qassam rockets because it is about a kilometer, 2 kilometers away from the Gaza Strip. And right next to Sderot is Sapir College, and that's where I teach. Okay?
So that just gives you an idea. So I live in an area that's called the surrounding Gaza region. Okay? So I live and I work in that area. I'm very happy to be here tonight, and I thank Partners for Peace and American University for inviting us. As you can hear from my voice, my accent, I was born in America, but I've lived most of my life in Israel. I'm Jewish. I was brought up in a what I call a very Jewish home, but not a religious home at all, a secular home. That means that for me and for my family and for many people that I knew, Judaism is a people that has a culture and a history and has languages and it has a religion, and all of that makes us a people. And so the Judaism that I was brought up on was not a religious one. I never went to synagogue. Actually, I went more often to churches because I lived in a very Catholic and Protestant neighborhood. We were the only Jewish family in our neighborhood. So my friends, when I was growing up, I actually spent more time in their churches than I ever spent in the synagogue. Only later I learned what it was to go to synagogue a little bit. The Judaism that I was always taught was one of values. And the values that I was taught from my father and from my mother were values of that everybody is equal. It doesn't matter what your race is, what your religion is, where you come from, who you are. Everyone is equal. Everyone is entitled to equal human and civil rights. That's the way my mother always lived her life. That's the way my father has always lived his life. And so that, for me, was always Judaism. I didn't know another kind of Judaism. Also, what a big part of my upbringing was Zionism. We were taught that the Jewish homeland, the historical, cultural homeland of the Jews, was Israel, and that there was a state, and that therefore the Jews should go back and live in their cultural, historical home. This was especially important. I was born after the Holocaust. My father, who came from Latvia originally, most of his family was killed in the Holocaust. The truth is I only found that out a few years ago. Most of my life I didn't even know that. But we were taught that that our home, our real home was Israel. And so that was also, that's what Zionism was. That's what I was taught. Zionism is a return to the land for the Jews. And I was especially taught a labor Zionist kind of, a labor socialist kind of Zionism. So therefore, I made plans to live on kibbutz, and I live on kibbutz. A kibbutz is a kind of commune, an agricultural rural commune based on socialism. That it, today it may be a dirty word. Back then it wasn't a dirty word. brotherhood, democracy. And so I moved to Israel when I was 19. I finished high school. I went to Israel for a year. I lived on a kibbutz. I came back to the States. I went to school for a year. And then I made the decision to make what we call Aliyah. Aliyah means, in Hebrew, it literally means to go up, to ascend, to immigrate to Israel. I did when I was 19. I had $100. I had two suitcases. I thought I was very rich, and I thought I was quite set. Today I look back and I say only a 19-year-old could have done such a stupid thing in 1972. And I also say to myself, where were my parents? Why did they let me do this? I think they thought I was going to come back. I think they thought I was going, okay, we'll let her do this and she'll be back, but I'm still there. So I've lived, as I said, most of my life in Israel. I got married, have three children. Natan was born in 1975. Noah, my daughter, was born in 1978, and our baby Danielle was born in 1985. So all my children born and raised on the kibbutz in Israel. When I went to Israel, as I said, I went out of what I thought were, I went out of ideals, ideology, what I thought was the correct ideology. I always thought of myself as a peace activist, as someone who was interested. Not only interested, this was a big part of my life. Social justice, I grew up during the 60s. So this was my life, and these were things that were important to me, and I was coming to Israel and actually to live the values that I believed in. I didn't know about Palestinians. I didn't know about Arabs. That's not quite true. I knew a little bit. I knew that they were all murderers. I knew that they wanted to throw us into the sea. I knew that it was only the Israelis who wanted peace, and that all the Israelis were always trying to achieve peace with the Arabs and later the Palestinians, but they weren't interested. That's what I knew. I am happy to say that I know a little bit more today. And as I've said often, it's not a lot of fun getting older, but one good thing about getting older is that hopefully you become a little bit wiser and you begin to see things in a little more complex term. And over the years, I've learned that that there's a difference between Arabs and Palestinians and different kinds of Arabs and different kinds of Palestinians. I've learned that everything that I was taught in the history about there being no Arabs or Palestinians in Israel-Palestine was not true. I've learned that many of the things that we were taught about how we always extended our hand in peace, well, not really, not always, that there was more than one side to the story. Over the years, I've been involved in many grassroots activities aimed at bringing about. I have to be much more modest here. Working at trying to work towards some kind of peaceful resolution, one small voice. For many years, I don't know, maybe some of you have heard about Women in Black. When Women in Black, we would stand on street corner wearing black. Okay, this is again really silly. For any of you who have been to that area, it's quite hot. And I live in the Negev, which is the desert. So there we are at Friday afternoon, 12 o'clock in the hot sun, wearing black. It's not real smart thing to do. Holding up signs against the occupation, when we were still in Lebanon during the first war. But I would do that. But for instance, just to show you that, again, and I think that was, I mean, I'm glad I did it, but I never ever thought to, and I was in charge, I would invite women from my kibbutz and other kibbutzim in the area to come and join us. Never occurred to me to ask any Arabs or Palestinians, would they be interested in standing with us? Never thought about it. It took me a few years to realize that it wasn't my job to make, that it wasn't enough for me to work with peace, with other peace activists who were Jewish Israeli, that I needed to actually try to do more to actually meet Palestinians and work with Palestinians. And those are things that I've tried to do over the years. One more thing I'll share with you before I end is coming to the realizations that this is not a black and white conflict, that there are at least two sides. And within each side, I mean, we Jews have this saying that if you get two Jews in a room, you have three opinions. And so that's really more or less also what it's like. We're very, very heterogeneous. And just like the Jews are heterogeneous and the Israelis are heterogeneous, so are the Palestinians. And so we have many different ideas. And we don't always agree, and often we don't agree within one another. And even within myself, I've had a lot of internal conflicts and turmoil trying to decide who I am, what I am, what do I believe in. And I've come to the realization that I'm many things and often contradictory, and it's okay, because this is part of growing up. You grow up until you die, you know, so that's okay. So for instance, when my two eldest children were in the Army, I was in favor of them going into the Army. I was proud that they were going into the Army. It never occurred to me to ever talk to them about maybe not going into the Army. Army service is compulsory for all 18-year-old men and women. But when my youngest, Danielle, when it was his turn to go into the Army, I, in the worst way, did not want him to go. And maybe part of it is he's my baby, and we tend to be, we tend to be especially protective of our babies. But I had many discussions with him where I said, Danielle, maybe you won't go into the Army. You know, there is such a thing as conscientious objection. And Danielle would say, oh, Ima, oh, Mom, you know, give it a break, you know, forget it. So I would say this to him. So I talked to him about it, and my husband would sometimes get angry at me also. Stop saying this to him. You're confusing him. And I would say, no, I'm going to say it, and I will respect whatever he does. And he chose to go into the Army, and during part of his Army service, he also did serve at times in the territories at checkpoints. And I have to admit that at those times, I felt very, very guilty for what I had done, because I thought that I was putting him in danger. I was putting him in physical danger. I was putting him in psychological danger, and I wasn't sure what he was facing and how he was reacting. I wanted to think I would know what he would do, but my belief is that there is no such thing as a benevolent occupier. So you may be a nice soldier at the checkpoint, but you're still a soldier at the checkpoint in occupied territory. So I have many more stories which I can share, but I'm going to end it here and leave time for my colleagues. And I hope I just gave you a little taste of what it's like to be an Israeli Jew who moved to Israel on purpose, who doesn't know whether she considers herself a Zionist anymore or not, or what kind of Zionist, and keeps on trying to smile through all this. Thank you.
Hi. My name is Lucy. I'm really so happy to be here, especially I have an old friend that I met her. She was an intern in Palestine for 3 weeks, and she's here. So I'm so excited to see her before. And also, I know Dr. Mohammed Abu Nimer, who's been in Jordan for the launching of his book. So I'm glad to be here again seeing you.
Are you?
I'm reading this notes. Okay, before I start my presentation, I would like to take you flashback, historical, to Palestine, and to see what Palestine looked like from the 47 to 2003. I would like to say first that during the 20th century, the Palestinian has been exposed and exiled. That's a result of the creation of the Israeli state during the 48. You will see the partition that happened during the 47, historical partition as two states for the Palestinian and for the Arabs. That's been 45% and the one Jewish 55% for the Jew. That's the result of the declaration of refugees in all over the world. This map actually will give you 47, the United Nations partition, 67, the invasion of Israel occupation, the West Bank Strip, and also 2000 with Barak offers 2003 with Sharon plans. And now see, you can see Palestine how look likes. That started 47. Try to focus on the green and then see how it goes. Now, with the Barak offers, we have like a shrink Palestine. Get back from where I am. I'm Palestinian living in Bethlehem. Bethlehem, it's been a grotto, and now it's a ghetto. Being a Christian Palestinian living in Bethlehem is so hard. The life is so tough, especially when you raised up in a closed place. Actually, it's a prison with the wall that the constructed started July 2001. It surrounded the whole land around Bethlehem. What you can do, just 15 minutes by car, and this is the only freedom movement you have. This is the only way you can, if you want to get out of this place, you have to get a permit. I raised in a family that during the war of 67, I lost my grandpa, my aunt, and my uncle. So I have like a hatred inside myself at the beginning. Why? Why that's happened to them? I grew up in my teenage. I found out that there is the centers in Palestine called WIAM Center, WIAM Palestinian Center for Conflict Resolution. I decided to enter the center and to discover this world, what they call it, nonviolence. I wasn't believing in nonviolence. I was a Christian. I want Palestine, all Palestine, during that time. So I started there just to get information, what they are doing, to see if I'm fitting to this place or not. Actually, the first 3 years, I wasn't fitting to that place at all. Cross-cultural project, dialogue between Israeli and Palestinian, I'm against it. Because I felt that this is not the right place for me. Being with Israel is killing my family. Why should I sit with them? So at the beginning, it was hard for me to accept that. But later on, I discovered it's the right place for me. Nonviolence, where I'm working in the WIAM Center, it's a center for nonviolence. We are like raising awareness within the Palestinian society about nonviolence resistance. And we are trying to do a demonstration, visual, and also doing a training in nonviolence and conflict resolution, how the people should be aware how to resolve their conflict. Actually, we're doing that in the national level. Excuse my voice. And we have different projects in our centers for women, for children also. We're trying to give them the safe environments to speak, to air out their stress. Because let's say in Bethlehem, we have only one park left. Most of the land being confiscated to building the wall under the security reason. So we're trying to find a way how to help our society. And this is one of the reasons that we are doing this project. And also I'm working especially with women. I'm trying to raise their awareness about their rights, about how to be a decision maker, to involve in the political level, how to affect. And actually I did one conference on UN Resolution 1325, which is talk about the impact of the war on the woman. And we have another one, will be in December. It will be Israeli-Palestinian to put a plan how to implement this project, the UN resolution. During my work, I found that there is a lot of violation in our society about human rights violations. So I found that it's very important to educate myself first in order if I want to help my people. I decided to go to university here in Beer Zeit. Actually, Beer Zeit, it's like 20 kilo from Bethlehem to Beer Zeit. Usually, in the regular time, it takes you 1 hour, 1 hour and a half. But because there's a lot of strangulation of movement on our ways, there's a lot of checkpoints. We have a regular checkpoints and we have a flight checkpoint. Flight checkpoints, they are putting it in different places. Sometimes you find it and sometimes you don't find it. But there is also regular checkpoints, which you'd be asked to give your identity and wait in a queue, and might take you hours and hours, and you have to wait. And it takes me sometimes 10 hours minimum to go back home. So this is one of the rights that I'm fighting too. Like, in which way I'm using nonviolence? If I stop on the checkpoints, I will listen to music, maybe, or to read, in order to air out the stress that I have it inside myself. This is one of the ways. Well, I guess I will end in this. And if you have any questions later on, I will be ready. Okay, hello everybody.
Please don't move.
Okay, I'll move like that. My name is Ines. I come from Jerusalem. As I always like to say, I'm Palestinian refugee, Arab, Muslim from East Jerusalem. I always actually wanted to be like with a kind of identification that give me the name Palestinian. But when I came to the States, and I usually travel abroad often, I travel with two documents. The first document is the travel document, and it's given to me by the State of Israel. And actually, my nationality listed or labeled as Jordanian. So it says that I'm Jordanian, and I reside on East Jerusalem, and I actually have the permit to live in Jerusalem on a visa. So I actually live in my country on a visa. For ages, we've been actually living in Palestine because my dad is from Jaffa, historical Palestine. We have a UN refugee card beside that, of course. And one time, I'll tell you a very interesting story. I studied in Egypt film directing. And one time my travel document expired. So I needed to go to the Israeli embassy, of course, in Cairo to renew the travel document. To my surprise, they told me, we cannot renew your travel document. We need to give you a tourist visa. And then when you go back to Israel, you go to the Ministry of Interior and you renew your travel document. So when they actually stamped a tourist visa on my travel document, I was really in shock, and I actually realized how sad the situation in Jerusalem, because we're not accepted, and we will always be labeled as whatever. Not only Jordanians; they might invent another citizenship. So yeah, and then the next passport I have is Jordanian passport, and this Jordanian passport does not actually allow me to live in Jordan. I have to have a kind of a permit to go to Jordan because I don't have a national number in Jordan. So yeah, so without those two, I'm basically whatever.
Can I take this out?
Yes.
Because I really don't feel comfortable doing like that.
Okay.
Let me start first of all with my relationship with in Palestine, with the whole Palestine-Israeli conflict. I remember clearly when I was very young that the flag that we had at home was, you know, red, white, black, and green, which is the Palestinian flag colors. And the flag on the street is white and blue with a star in the middle. So I didn't really understand that, but my dad used to tell me that I used to always complain and say, Dad, why don't we have the same flag on the street at home, or vice versa? So he started like explaining the whole thing. And by time, he developed this very super idea, which is the Friday lesson. Because, you know, at school, we learn Islamic history. Nothing that is related to Palestine history at all. I mean, we're not, I mean, according to Israeli authorities, of course, they review the curriculum, and we just study Islamic history from the Prophet, then to the Khulafa, and then we go back. And then they might add something later when you're like second elementary or fourth elementary. So it was really tiring not to study our own history and not to know anything about Palestine and what's the reason why we're actually under occupation. So my dad developed this Friday lesson, may his soul rest in peace, and he used to like tell us stories about Yaffa and about his homeland and how he actually managed to study at the age of 35 to finish his BA, because when they were living in Yaffa, they had like, you know, houses and land, and they thought that they don't need to work. My grandfather at least thought that he doesn't need to work. So my father faced really hard time afterwards, and he started working in Germany in the summer to earn money and studying in Egypt during winter. So yeah, so my relationship with the whole, not relationship, well, my understanding of the whole Palestine-Israel conflict came on a really like early age. Why am I telling you this? Because of I love stories. I like to be a storyteller, and that's why I decided to study filmmaking. And I'm not gonna take longer than that, but I prepared a part of the last 5 minutes of my latest short film. It's called Occupy Zion. And in that film, I actually reversed the roles of the occupier and the occupied, where Palestinians are actually occupying Israel. And that to prove one thing only, is that the problem is not with the situation in Palestine. The problem is with who is the occupier and who is the occupied. And I believe that if the occupied were Israelis and not Palestinians, this whole situation would have been solved long time ago. And also it gave me the chance to actually portray to the other what kind of suffering and what does this occupation to me, what does it mean to me and to all Palestinians. So these are the last 5 minutes, and then we're open to Q&A. Thank you very much for your time.
Does it have volume? No.
Hold the microphone
to it.
I'm sorry.
Do I mute? I cannot remove it.
Yeah.
Can somebody just fix it? So we have volume now? Mm-hmm.
I cannot believe that we once stood in support of the Palestinian plight.
Just because we're Jews, no one really cares about our plight.
Peace is possible.
But not many Palestinians are interested in a real solution. I mean, why would they care?
We are neighbors. We have to accept the fact that we can't count on Europe or the United States or even the Arab world to solve our problems. We can do it without their interference. Don't you think so?
Israel, we are tired of emotional support. What we need is a real support from the world. But they have done nothing yet. The UN has passed many resolutions against Palestine years ago. But come on, things are only getting worse.
לכיבוש הפלסטיני. זה הזמן לעולם כולו למצוא פתרון צודק לבעיה שלנו.
This demonstration is okay, but it's not going to accomplish much. Besides, we have the most powerful military in the Middle East.
Palestine, מדינת האויב, נכשלה. תהליך השלום קרס ונכשל. הדרך היחידה להשגת חופש לעמנו הינה מאבק לאומי. השלום הוא חיוני.
Hey, Michael, come on. I'm waiting for the stand-up. I don't think anything major is going to happen here. Yeah, the occupation. Blah, blah, blah.
Rolling.
Okay, that's fine? Look good?
Yeah, the hair, yeah, good.
Okay.
Boom, boom, boom. That's it. Good, that's good.
The Israeli demonstrators are gathered here today to commemorate 59 years of Palestine occupation. Their message, together with Palestinians and European peace activists, is clear. It's about time to have peace. This is Ali James, reporting from Jerusalem, Palestine.
Thank you for good evening. I'm Mohammed Abu Namer, and this panel is something that we've done for the last 4 or 5 years at the AU. We host the Partners for Peace panel in sponsorship, wide sponsorship from the AU, and it's not only for my class. So I hope it's for the entire community. Before we open to the questions and answers, just to recognize that there have been several groups who really work on this, the Student for Justice in Palestine, the Washington College of Law, and the Jewish Students Association for providing as well refreshment and support of the event, the Center for Social Media for filming the event, the WCL for creating broadcast of the event, and hopefully the university publication will document this as well. And I have 13 organizations who for the first time at the AU got excited about sponsoring this event. And for the outsider, this is really an achievement for us. So, because usually we have one or two and we cannot really convince the different group on campus that this is helpful. So your presence here allowed our students' clubs to come together, and really that's something very positive, at least for us as a community. So thank you for coming here and sharing your thoughts. Now you're supposed to clap. Now we can move on and take some questions and answer from you. Hopefully you can frame your question in a constructive way, as well as a clarifying point if you have them. And don't hesitate to ask any question as long as you put it that way. And I'll try to take questions from not only my class. You can address the question to one person or to the entire panel. Yes, please.
Hi. My question goes to your short film. You said before it started that, and correct me if I interpreted you wrong, that you believed it was the occupier and who was occupying, and not necessarily just a conflict between two peoples. And I was just interested in your explanation on that point.
What I meant is that I don't think that the problem is with the situation in Palestine. For me, there is an oppressor and there is an oppressed. The wrong thing is about oppression. It's not who is the identity of the oppressor or the oppressed. And I think, and I really strongly believe, that because if it was not us under, if it was us occupying Israelis, it would have been different, and I think the problem would have been solved a long time ago. But Palestinians are kind of forgotten in the pages of history, and at least for the last 60 years, up to the 87, when I was 15, I think, or 14 years old, that I actually felt that there is now a kind of someone waiting at us and say, hello, we know who you are. But before that, I used to travel, and when I used to say the word Palestine, nobody really knew. Oh, Pakistan? Where does it? Where is it? It's next to Jordan. We're next to Jordan. I mean, I was trying to say, and then when I said, I live in Jerusalem, I'll say, yeah, you mean Israel. But there's no Palestine. What is Palestine? So this is the whole thing.
And why do you believe that the Palestinians would be so much more successful in solving the conflict?
Because, I mean, I'm not going to get into the politics, who's affecting the public opinion in the world, and who's weak and who's powerful. We all know that perfectly well, I think. And we are weak. We're 3.5 million inside Palestine. We're 3.5 million in the diaspora. And we're not even close to affecting the world view or power. So.
We have the room for longer than this.
Don't feel hesitated. I mean, we're open to questions. You could ask whatever you want.
So, I thank you for coming. It was really interesting to hear yourself, and I totally agree that oppression and stuff like that, and some of the injustices that are being committed, are wrong and stuff like that. But when it comes, I'm just looking at the summary of what the Jerusalem Women's Week is trying to discuss, and it doesn't, like, maybe, I don't know if this is constructive criticism or something like that, but it doesn't seem to be in the explanation highlighting oppression. It seems to be highlighting the conflict. So. If you're going to discuss the conflict, there are other issues to the conflict besides oppression. I agree that oppression is a big part of it. I would just want to know if any of you guys can address some of the other issues of the conflict.
If I may, just to help the specific,
yeah,
do you have a specific issue within the conflict that you would like to get a response from them? I think they'll make their response more concrete.
I just would like to hear, like, because, I mean, terrorist acts, like, it has happened and stuff. So I just want to get a sense of what the goal that you guys see of, I understand terrorism is on the decline, and that's good, and the community as a whole is doing better. But how you feel that plays into the conflict, and whether or not you feel that what you see that as.
So really the specific point is the attacks on Israel from Gaza, as well as suicide bombing and all the terrorist activity that you referred to, right?
Can I just say one sentence?
The conflict for me started a long way before definition of terrorism. Simply put, my father was born in Yaffa in 1935 or 1936. I was born in 1977, and up to the early 90s where the first suicide bombing happened. So we need to explain history up to this point and then be able to actually analyze history afterwards, or analyze how is this related to the conflict. This is my own personal...
Yeah, no, but the conflict goes back. I mean, the conflict starts with the state, but there were Jews there since
1890. I'm talking about, like, the whole problem of historical Palestine and, you know, the Balfour, like 1948 and onwards. Of course, it's related more than that, but from my knowledge and from my living, what I relate to as the conflict starts from what is related to my father's story, as I said earlier. Okay.
I think that it's very difficult to try to find, it's kind of what we say is chicken and egg. And the way that I look at it is the Palestinians and the Israelis, we've been at this for way too long. And so in my opinion, it really doesn't, it doesn't even matter who started, and I don't know who started it, and I don't think that's going to help. What I have seen, and maybe in the little blurb that you read about me, I'm a social psychologist. My field is the psychosocial effects of massive social trauma on its victims and its descendants. And what I've seen, this is something I've researched for years, research of the Holocaust, research of the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. And what I've seen is that we just have a society, societies and cultures that are built around violence, and they're built around more and more violence and more vengeance. And so, therefore, this keeps on feeding into one another. So
I'm not trying to say one side started.
No, I understand. I understand. I'm just saying the way that I look at it is that when a Qassam rocket or when 20 Qassam rockets, and today I got an email, we have a ceasefire, but the IDF went into Gaza and killed some Palestinians, and so there were Qassam rockets on Sderot. And so again, it's so easy for us to get into this violence, and then what happens is that it just keeps on feeding on itself. And so the occupation is a big part of it, the violence is a big part of it, and what we need to do is we need to change our perspective and what we want to do, and we need to realize after at least 60 years that more and more violence is not going to end it.
Lucy, you want to respond to that?
No.
Yes, Natalie?
On a slightly more upbeat note.
She's one of my students.
You might want to wait to say that.
She does that.
Can you stand up when you ask your question?
Can you stand so other people can hear?
Okay. So it seems like dialogue has been one of the more productive methods of peace building that has been used and has been on the uprise recently. And we've read some articles saying that one of the limitations of dialogue is that only the peripheral ideas are addressed as opposed to discussing the real concrete problems. And one of the big kind of issues is obviously religion. And a lot of people don't want to discuss religion in dialogue. And obviously in the Palestinian-Israeli context where the issue of Jerusalem, the issue of who has control over certain holy sites are some of the top issues that can't be separated from religion. So how do you create a safe space to not only discuss political issues, but also incorporate the religious issues that can't really be separated?
Actually, for us, it's so hard to meet with Israelis. Maybe it's easier for us as a Palestinian to meet the Israelis as abroad, but not inside Palestine or Israel. They are not allowed to enter Palestinian territory. And if we want to go to Israel, we need a permit, and it's not that easy to get a permit to go. The second, dialogue is very important between the Israeli and Palestinian. But actually, in order to build bridges, they are building wall between us and them. And it's so hard to have dialogue. And to ask me, like, to reconcile, and I'm in a jail. It's so hard. Religious is a, for me, I can see it as an incitement for conflict. Usually the people interpret it and it will create, it's a resource of conflict, not resource of peace. What we are trying to be far from religions, because we as a Palestinian, and I know that the Israelis too, that the international think our conflict is irreligious, and actually it's not religious. It's between occupier and occupied places. So if we get rid of the occupier, then we have the space, maybe, to talk and work together. But within the walls, it's so hard, I guess, to have dialogue.
So do you think dialogue, though, it's like the chicken and the egg thing, can dialogue be the first step in getting rid of the wall? Does dialogue have to happen in order for the occupation, the occupier, to maybe be forgotten?
She's asking you more specifically. It sounded like you were making a precondition to meet with the Israeli for the occupation to end. And she's saying, will you meet with the Israelis before the war or occupation ends?
Yes, it was easier for us to meet with them. It was easy. We did lots of cross-cultural projects with Israelis-Palestinian dialogue. It was very important for us. You know, I'm living in Bethlehem, she's living in Jerusalem, and even there is a lot of Jewish living in Jerusalem. We don't know nothing about each other. So how could I know about their living if I'm not able to cross? I have lots of strangulation of movement to enter. In which way can I? And also there is an issue, hot issues. Usually when there is, let's say, a meeting between Israel and Palestine, you cannot talk about it, which is water, Jerusalem, settlement. There is like five issues is pending. We are not allowed to talk about it. Then in which way we are going to talk? About what? About our daily life? Or to social together? I don't think this is the reason. The reason is we have to build bridges between us and them in order to achieve the peace between the two and to exist together and live in peace.
Yes, actually, I've written quite a bit about dialogue. And if you Google my name, I've written about safe spaces for dialogue between enemies, between Palestinians and Israelis. And I have a piece coming out soon in the International Journal of Peace Studies called Bridging the Impossible, about obstacles to dialogue and how to open up the dialogue. I think we can discuss anything. I don't think it's a way of political positions, because political positions leads to no dialogue. But I always prefer a storytelling, personal experiences, and using that. And I come from the aspect that there should be no taboo subjects. But the question is how to talk about it. Not to make things taboo, but to make it in a way that people can listen. Because if what you're doing is, once you get into political discussions, then you have people getting entrenched in their positions. But when you have people talking about their personal experiences, not because we want to like one another on a personal level. Yes, we want to do that as well. But the conflict is not an interpersonal conflict. It's an intergroup, international conflict between peoples. So what we need to do is to open that up so that we can begin to really see and understand what the other's gone through. So there are ways to deal with it. And I think that we need to do that even as the wall is being built. Because otherwise, the more we don't talk, then the harder it does become to talk.
I just want to say, like myself and Lucy, we're privileged Palestinians that we could go abroad and talk about our own experience, and we could have dialogue and, you know, understand and go back and forth with discussion. Many Palestinians, many living in refugee camps, are not as privileged as we are, and they need a solution. They need a kind of a change in their daily life that will motivate them to actually encourage them to have a dialogue. But unfortunately, and for so many years, whenever we talk about a kind of a solution, it became worse. And to be honest, I cannot lie to my people and say it's going to be better, because without a change on the ground, it's going to be lying. And I don't think that talking and lying and pretending something that it does not exist is a good thing to do. Actually, it will make things worse.
Yes, go ahead.
Enemies and the problems when you identify them as enemies, I think that's a little bit currently it's a situation they're considered enemy, but the real problem is you have the Europeans that killed the Jews and washed their hands with Palestinian blood, and whenever they always live in Arab countries safely, and there is no animosity. It's not like a religious problem. Like she said, I think the problem is dehumanizing the Palestinians. And they ask this Lebanese author who wrote The Gate of the Sun, what's his name?
Not the Lebanese,
Khoury. They ask him, do you think maybe through the literature you can solve the problem and have this dialogue? And he said, no, not really, because what happened is the Israelis walk on the shadow of Palestinians, and they don't see them like human beings. And in Hebrew literature, it's either a stupid man or someone who is a peasant. So there is no way. And to respond. how the gentleman respond. Even the mayor of Cedaron said, let's have a truth, and let's have a truth, and let's communicate. I mean, even people in Cedaron, they want to have peace, but I think Israel is a little bit in a difficult situation because this is a terrible situation for them, and peace also could be a terrible situation for them. I think that's the issue.
So really, there is no question. You just wanted to make statements, which is fine with me.
How to get...
you're now looking for the question.
To get beyond them and to recognize the dehumanizing, I think that's very important. Because she mentioned also the Holocaust, and lots of people think what's happening in Israel now and in Palestine. Yeah, this is exactly what happened in the Holocaust. For example, there is high rate of people beating their kids and lots of social and...
Maybe Julie can respond to
that. Yeah, because that's why I want to talk about these issues.
Go ahead, Julie.
The dehumanization of the Palestinians.
There's no doubt, and this is one of the... This is for me is one of the greatest tragedies is that, yes, we Israelis have come to definitely de-individualize and dehumanize Palestinians. And most people don't want to know. And even though there's no problem in knowing what's going on today in the West Bank, I mean, there is no problem of information. Many, many Israelis just don't want to know. I don't think that there's one problem. There are many, many problems. I said enemies, I used it on purpose just to show that this is the way that most people look at one another. And the wall may be a concrete symbol of not wanting to see the other. You brought up the issue of Sderot. I just want you to know that I belong to a grassroots organization that's called Other Voice, comes out of Sderot. And what we do is we meet every week, and every week we phone people in Gaza because we cannot meet with them. And we talk to them on the phone, and it's surrealistic because we sit in a circle and there's a little cell phone in the middle, and we turn on the speaker and we're speaking to people in Gaza who are probably 2 or 3 kilometers away from us. And right now we're working on trying to have a meeting because we think that a basic civil and human right of people is that they can meet with their friends. And so that's what we're working towards. But I think that the problem is that for so long, we have seen one another's enemies, and both sides have become so entrenched in seeing the other as enemies and the one who wants to wipe them off the face of the earth, that what happens is that you become afraid, and the more afraid you are, and the more barriers you put up, and the more that it becomes impossible to meet. I can't go to Gaza. So I think that the peace will come through the politicians. They're the ones that have to sign the peace treaty. But we people, we have to do something. Because otherwise there'll be no peace.
Thank you. Anyone from this side? I just want to tell you they ask more questions. Yes, with the help of you. Yeah. All right, go ahead.
Hello, my name is Michael. Shalom, salam. This is the word for peace, right?
Yes.
And I think it's no coincidence that the word for peace is similar in both Hebrew and Arabic. I mean, it's similar, and I think that what we're all looking for is very similar. What you are looking for is similar. But, I mean, peace is such a broad word. What to you, as representatives of your state, of your beliefs, and as of yourself, what to you is peace? Is it the ending of the violence? Is it creation of another state? Is it a dual state solution? Is it just completely scrapping everything and starting anew? What are your opinions? What to you will be the final peace where you can sit with any Israeli, any Palestinian, anyone from the top to the bottom, from Lebanon all the way to the Sinai, and shake their hand and just say, we're done. What you looking for?
I just want to say one sentence. For me, literally one sentence. Peace is the outcome. Justice is the solution. That's it.
I think you need to unpack that later.
I told you one sentence. Lucy.
Well, you ask about two state or one state solution, and what for us peace? For me, peace when I live in security. Peace, internal peace first I have to have, and then looking forward the other peace. Peace for me as a Palestinian, I have a dream that to have my Palestinian state. I'm looking forward. In which way? And violence. Equal rights. I have my freedom to move from any place. Not if I want to go to Jerusalem, I have to spend 6 years to get a permit to go to Jerusalem for a worship. I spent from 2000 to 2006 in order to get a permit to go to worship in the Palm Sunday. Is it fair? It's not fair at all. I have the right to go and worship whenever I want, but there is lots of abuses and violence against the human rights in Palestine. For me, Palestinian states will come. I do believe in two-state solution, to have our own maps, on the maps, Palestinian states, all the world to recognize us as a Palestinian, not as a terrorist. This is what I want. I have a dream, and I wish my dream will go through one day, if not in my generation, maybe in other generation, but this is what I'm looking forward.
It's dangerous to say these words, I have a dream in the US after the election.
Okay, I want to change.
Yes,
my dream will come. Martin Luther said, I have a dream.
Yes.
So I have a dream.
Julie?
Yes, I think that peace is a physical and psychological security. I think without any security, and both peoples are lacking it. I know for sure on the Israeli side, and I can pretty, from what I understand, on the Palestinian side. Right now, I think if we could get a little of that security on both sides, that would go a long way. And I even say now we don't have to love one another, but we have to learn to get along somehow. So I think that's a long way coming. But for me, peace will be that both peoples will have physical, psychological security. Both people will be able to wake up in the morning and not worry about, I won't have to worry about a Qassam rocket hitting me as I'm parking my car at Sapir College. And Lucy and Inas won't have to worry about an IDF Air Force helicopter coming over and by mistake or not by mistake, blowing them up or somebody else up. I think that when we get up in the morning with these fears, then it's a little bit hard to think of peace. So I hope that that will pass soon.
Thank you. Yes, Chris.
Just speaking as a Christian who's living in America, I see a lot of exploitation of the conflict to sort of meet with, you know, people who we believe are our brethren. You know, there are Christians who exploit the Israeli side because of sort of a sense of brethren that there must be an Israel in order for Jesus to come back.
That's the Christians.
Yeah, that's the American Christians. The American Zionist Christians, not necessarily me. it's not a monolith. I mean, Christians in America aren't a monolith. So, but there are those factions, and I just wondered how. I mean, this is the first time that I've ever heard from a Palestinian Christian, and I just wonder how the others feel about international religious groups exploiting or not exploiting your side of the conflict in order to gain from it. Not necessarily the American Christian Zionist, but just any religious group who seeks to benefit from your conflict.
Can you please rephrase it? No, not rephrase, I get it, but like, you mean Iran and other countries, like religious?
If you feel that Iran is exploiting, you know, your situation, then yes, I would like you to comment on that. But if you don't feel that, then that's, I mean, if you don't feel that any Muslim religious group is exploiting your conflict, that's fine. But are there?
Well, I'm not a political analyst, and to be honest, sometimes I choose to study one thing at a time because too much politics in my head, living and studying and reading and etc., gets on my nerves. What I believe for now, there are many things happening around the situation in Palestine. I'm not sure where is this leading to be honest with you, and I cannot add something different. But when I do, I'll email you.
Maybe we take Julie first and then you can think about it. Yes.
I'm against exploitation of any kind.
But do you see other do you, do you see?
Yes, of course, because people are always exploiting the situation, whether it's the Zionist Christians, I didn't even know that that was their name, or whether it's Jewish groups that are exploiting it, or whether it's extreme Muslims, of course, you know, using it for other reasons. I was in Northern Ireland a few years ago. We were driving down the road, and we saw flags, Palestinian flags in some part, and Israeli flags in other parts in Northern Ireland, and I said, what's going on? And they said, yes, the Protestants are for the Israelis, and the Catholics are for the Palestinians. And I got really angry. I said, you know, why are they putting my flag there? I didn't ask them to put my flag there. How do they know what I think? So there's exploitation there, and I think the Northern Ireland have enough to deal with on their own, so I didn't like that anyway.
Lucy, is there something?
Well, I'm thinking if something will happen with Al-Aqsa Mosque, then the Islamic world maybe could move a little bit on effects on what is going in the land. Actually, recently, what I heard, that Israel want to build a museum, they call it Tolerance Museum, on the land of the Islamic cemetery. And that's create a big conflict right now. We lost in the court now, and I don't know what's happening right now on that issue. That could be also explode.
I think that the point that there are many sites, many issues related to religion that can be exploited, and the cases recently in the news could be also another one for exploitation. Yes, with the yellow.
I know that we've talked a lot about people, and both Palestinian people and Israeli people. We've also talked a lot about the Israel. Well, we haven't here, but I hear a lot about the Israeli government and things that are going on in the Israeli government, and I'm just wondering how you both relate to, well, this is for Inas and Lucy more than usually, how do you relate to your own leadership? For the past 60 years, as you showed, Lucy, the map has changed, and I think that reflects a lot about the leadership that's gone on in the Israeli government as well as the Palestinian government. And I'm just wondering how you relate to your leadership and how you relate to other Arab countries. I'm wondering if you, this is the second question, I'm sorry, if you feel a sense of responsibility or that other Arab countries are responsible to you as well. Do you feel a sense of pan-Arabism, is that a correct
term? Yes.
Or not so much?
Two questions really. One, the first is, how do you feel about the responsibility of the Palestinian leadership from the last few decades in terms of bringing the Palestinian to this situation? And how do you feel about the role of the Arab countries and Arab regimes toward this conflict historically?
Well, for me, I can't see the problem with the leader. The problem is with the occupier, with the power. As a Palestinian, I do believe that we are like a swing. The power, there is no balance between us and the Israelis. They have the power, they have the weapons, they have the support from all over the world. We are down and they are up. This is related to the leadership. I don't think this is related to our leadership. Maybe in some points our leadership missed up, but I can tell that during Oslo Agreement in 1993, when our leader signed for it, our ex-president Arafat signed for it. Not all of the Palestinians, they were agree on that. They accepted. And in order what? To get 20% of the history of Palestine. And after that, we've been like, there is no implementation, just talk without any work or any implementation on the peace process. That's created the other conflict. And now, with Abu Mazen is a very peaceful person. He's sitting, he's accepting everything, but actually we are not getting anything. So do you think it's the problem with our leader or the problem with the power?
I would disagree with you a bit. Well, of course, I agree with you that, you know, you have the powerful part of this equation. Of course, it's Israel, and without Israel agreeing on a real solution for the Palestinians, it will not be possible. But I think that the Palestinian leadership is to blame because they're trying to satisfy everybody. So they're trying to satisfy the Palestinians, they're trying to satisfy the Americans, they're trying to satisfy the Europeans and the Israelis. So you cannot really do that. You either say, this is the solution, and here are the terms and the conditions. If not, then dismantle the PA, go back to one, we are under United Nations supervision, and end of the story. But you cannot go and saying, okay, let's do that, let's try that, because you know this cannot keep happening forever. For the second part of your question, maybe many Palestinians throughout the years, up to maybe 1987, believed in Arab unity, you know, of course, because of Jamal Abdel Nasser, and many feel that they're like kind of guilty because what happened to Palestinians happened because of the Arabs. They failed them in 1967. Today, as a Palestinian in 2008, I believe that I no longer want any Arab to stand for my right. I am, as a Palestinian, the only one who should defend and fight for Palestine. And that's for one simple reason, is that you need to be part of it, you need to be devoted, and you cannot have that on a distance, and you cannot sing about the past and about, you know, Arab nationalism, because whether we like it or not, it does no longer exist anymore.
Yes.
Maybe this will speak a little bit more to Anas and the rest of you, but I have a question about the role of the media or exposure. I guess all of you, because you're on this tour, are part of international exposure. What do you think the role of international exposure to the media, or through, I mean, you guys coming and speaking, kind of, what role do you feel that plays as part of the conflict?
What kind of role the media plays in the whole?
In the whole, I mean, because I guess you guys being on tour, I think I would assume.
It's our first day.
But I mean, you joined for a reason, I guess. Yeah. Why? Maybe why that, or just what do you think could be a useful?
Yeah, I guess the two parts of the question: why did you join this tour? The second one is you will be exposed to public media. How do you see the role of the? Is it really influential? Do you put lots of weight on the impact, on the effect you're going to create?
And I mean, I would include everything up into your thoughts. This is media, obviously. So.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead, start, then we'll go to Julie, because we...
Do you want me to speak?
Yeah. Yes, go ahead.
Of course, I believe strongly that media affects and forms public opinion. And I mean, I didn't choose filmmaking for that. I chose filmmaking to be a film director because I like to tell stories. Why am I here on this tour? You know, we hear a lot about American role in the whole, you know, situation back home. And we know for a fact that if people are more kind of familiar with the situation and understand really the situation, they might, you know, grow up one day. You might be the president one day, nobody knows. So yeah, I was really motivated because I really wanted to meet with American audience. Because sometimes I used to tell my American friends back home, why don't you get it? You know, it's not rocket science. And I mean, for me back home, it's so simple. But when one person asked me a question and they said, oh, now we understand. I said, why? What did you hear? It's like, oh, back home when we see the news, it's nothing. It's nothing compared to that. And this is where I come to know and be familiar with the terms of how media really affects the public opinion in the States. I really was not aware of how strong it is and how does it affect it.
Julia?
Mm-hmm. I came on this tour because I was given the opportunity to speak in, I think it's 25 venues, but I think the list has grown. So I feel honored to have the opportunity to speak to so many people and to say the message that I want, which is a very non-mainstream Israeli message. That I am a proud Israeli, I'm a patriotic Israeli, and I'm an Israeli for the good of Israel that wants peace and that wants to treat its neighbors with dignity and respect and full rights. So I came so I could say that at least 25 times and probably more. And do I think the effect of the media? Of course. Of course the media has effect. It has effect in Israel, it has effect everywhere. I know that the U.S. media tends to, everything is very short, so I don't think I'm going to have a great impact, and I'm thinking that they'll probably take the few words and put them together in a way that I did not mean at all, but maybe I'll be wrong. But I'm hoping that if I get this message out, that at least some ears will hear it, and something will start changing.
For me, joining this... these talks, it's a great chance and honor. First of all, you will hear from us stories you will never hear from the media. Media doesn't cover everything. It shows you maybe 1%. And it depends on the media. If you take Fox News, who said it's pro what? If you take CNN, what they cover? Most of the things that they
not
will show,
international, please.
They, most of the things that what they show, it might be bloody. I never saw on the TV when we did lots of demonstration against the wall, against like what's going on. In these days, we have like the olive harvest. Lots of clashes and conflict happen between settlers and the farmer. So we, as one of the organizations that join other organizations, Palestinian and also Israelis, do you think that the media show that on the TV? How we have the clashes between the soldiers, even like the human rights, Rabbi for Human Rights or other peace activists? They will not show you that. So you will get a real story. You will never hear it from the media. And about the second question, what was?
No,
oh, joining.
Yes.
Okay.
Convinced?
Somehow, not satisfied.
Yes, I'm yes.
Thank you. My question is for Ines.
Yes.
I would like you guys to tell us what it means to be a woman in Palestine right now.
Yeah.
What we learn from the media, from the book, is that Palestinian women live between two fires, like male domination on the one side and occupation on the other side. So what? How do you guys see the situation?
We are revolutionists, that's why we are here.
Is the question?
Yeah, it's very clear. To be honest, I didn't really feel it the way that another woman might in a village feel it. You know what I mean? I mean, I have my MA from London. I'm a filmmaker. I worked on so many Palestinian films as assistant director. And I remember clearly standing in the middle of Nablus or in the old city of Jerusalem, like in Nablus with Paradise Now, yelling and bossing everybody around to keep silent. And they never really gave me a hard time saying, oh, you woman, I never really get that. Of course, it happens sometimes with certain individuals, but on a larger scale, like on a daily basis, I don't really have this kind of frustration, to be completely honest with you.
Well, for me, through my works, I face lots of cases, especially dealing with women that coming from the villages. We are, as a society, we are living under patriarchal society and men dominated. So through our work, we're trying to raise the awareness of these women. To let them feel, or also to raise their self-esteem first. And then we will work with them on different things, on the educational level, vocational level. Also, we've been succeeded even to let some of the women, like being a member in the local council, and also in the municipality, let's say, of Bethlehem, and even in the legislative council. As one of the organizations that we are supporting these women to be on the decision maker and be on the political level too. Social, political level.
Maybe Julia wanna talk about the women in Israel or as well. The different challenges dilemma.
Oh yes, I'll have full equality in Israel, right? I live on a kibbutz, which is theoretically equality between men and women. That was also one of its values. And I can say that we're lacking there as well. But I think it's a very different situation for Israeli women, for Israeli Jewish women for sure, than for what I know of many Palestinian women.
Okay. Well, I promise to this. And then to you.
I had two questions, one for Lucy and one for Ines. Lucy, I was wondering, throughout your childhood and as you move into the peace activism field, did you feel any disconnect or hostility because you were a Christian Palestinian, or did you feel more unity because you guys were fighting for a common goal? Did you feel, did that make sense? And then, shall I say both of them?
Yeah.
And then I had another question, and you know, you say a lot about the problem is with the occupier and the occupied, and I was wondering, did you see a room for dialogue as an effective tool for this conflict?
For me, in a time I felt that I'm disconnected from the environment that I'm living around, like being from the left side, right side, going to the left side, it's a paradigm shift, it's a big shift in your life. Plus the environment will lead you, like what you are talking about, nonviolence, it's American trend. Why you want to import it and what we are going to do with that? So in our organization, actually we are integrating these like conflict resolution and mix it West and East, and we create our own methods to use it.
But the question also was regarding you as a Christian. When you grow up, did you feel any strain, conflict, resentment, rejection from Muslims, Palestinian, or
Well, actually,
no, she was confused with the second question.
Okay. Well, to be frank, I never like felt it that as a Christian living with Muslims that there is any misunderstanding. I do believe that we have our own goals to have our own states. That's why we are work and talk together to reach our goals, which is to have a vital Palestinian state. That's what. And also religious is part of like inside you for what? To deal with the others as a human? And this is what we are dealing with, even with the Israelis. Like, always I'm saying these words, like, we are here, I'm not like trying to let you be pro-Palestinian or pro-Israelis, but pro-justice. This is what we are looking forward.
I just wanted to say something about what Lucy said. I was brought up myself in a Catholic school. I mean, I'm a Palestinian Muslim, but I was brought up for about all my life, actually, since kindergarten in a Catholic school, and I finished when I was 18 years old. And, you know, I mean, we had the only class where we divided is when they go to the Christian lesson and we do them. Actually, we used to stay in the class because we're more than them. regarding your second question, I believe that, of course, dialogue is an efficient tool, but it's one tool out of many. The second thing is that I think dialogue, of course, is important, but there should be a timeline because we cannot keep on talking forever, you know. So there is we put a timeline, we discuss, we find solution, but there should be a timeline. And then afterward, we could continue the dialogue maybe over coffee when we're not really, you know, under constraint. But we cannot keep it for that forever.
Yes, question, and then I'll come back to you.
My name's Emily. I'm a representative of Students for Justice in Palestine. But I'm really curious. I know that the U.S. has played a major role in supporting Israel in this conflict, and especially monetary aid. It's a really huge deal. And so I'm curious if any all three of you, if you see a role for the U.S. In finding a real viable solution to the conflict, or do you think really that it's better if the U.S. and all other major Western powers just step back and say, this isn't, I mean, we can't impose what we see as a solution anymore, if you think it should really be from the ground up, you know, between Palestine and Israel, and not really with the brokerage of anybody else?
Thank you. Maybe we could start with Julia, because we haven't heard you for the last two questions.
It was Lucy and Inas. They were saying Lucy and Inas. It's not us.
I think that the powers do have to play. I think that they must play, because the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is not a purely Israeli-Palestinian conflict. It involves at least Jews and Muslims, and I'm also going to throw in Christians, throughout the world. We have huge diasporas. It doesn't matter really where you live. As I began my talk, I said the way that we Jews relate to one another as a people, we live throughout the world. So therefore, what happens with the Western Wall, with the Wailing Wall, is important to a Jew who lives in California or Buenos Aires or wherever. And just as what happens on the Temple Mount is important to a Muslim who lives wherever he or she may live. So, and actually I do think that we need the U.S. and we need the EU and we need the superpowers to, yes, I think they can't impose it, no, but I think that they need to be very strong, because I know that if they are very strong and working in a way for justice, then I know that they are going to force us to do things probably quicker than we've been able to do it ourselves. But we need to also do it from the ground up as well. Of course, it's not either or, but I definitely think that the superpowers have a very important role to play.
I will be concise. I will say that if U.S. want to achieve peace, one of the most things that should do it, which is stop giving aid, $4 million per year, for the military supporting Israel. This is one of the most things.
Billion, not million.
No, 4 billion?
Billion, not
4 billion each year. That's why, and also I blame the people here. You should stop pay your taxes or ask the government where it goes. If you want to achieve peace, you have to think about it.
We're in a transition now.
Optimistic.
I'm not going to speak.
I just want to say something. I believe that only the superpowers could actually impose, and I might disagree about the impose, because I believe that, you know, the UN resolutions are there. That we have UN resolutions that say 1967 borders, this is Palestine, end of the story. The solution is there, implement it. If there's a problem with implementation, then impose it.
You had a question?
It was the address.
Okay. Yes, please.
I had a question for all of you, but especially for Julie, on your thoughts about the wall and if you think that it should be torn down or if you think there is a purpose for it, what your beliefs are about that.
The facts on the ground are that the separation fence slash wall has drastically cut down terror attacks in Israel. That means that less Israelis are being killed by terror attacks because of the separation fence slash wall. I'm against building fences and walls. I'm against borders because I think they separate people. However, I also believe, and I also believe that the wall is going to come down. I'm sure of it, just as the Berlin Wall came down. I'm sure, and so it's, to me, very painful that we're spending these millions and millions of dollars for something that is going to come down. I mentioned this earlier before. I know that the Palestinians see the wall as creating a ghetto for them, but I look at it from the other side, and I say that for centuries, Jews lived in ghettos in Europe and in Northern Africa and other places. And we're used to living in ghettos, so I think we've put up the wall also to make us feel safer. In terms of that we're used to living in ghettos, it creates for us a ghetto as well. Our ghetto is larger, that's true. We live in a larger ghetto, but I think that that is part of the psychological part as well.
So you feel safer with this wall?
I think most people feel safer with this wall. I know that the wall is not going to bring the peace or the coexistence.
I want to comment on that. From Palestinian side, I cannot see it as safer. I can see it more confiscating land. If you want to be safer, build it on your land. Why you should build it on the Palestinian and taking more land and land? There is no more land for us. This is the part. I do believe the wall will fall one day. What's happened in South Africa, in Berlin, I do believe in that. The dawn will come one day. How much the darkness? But we'll see the light later. But this is what, let's say have a hope. This is the only things that we are living.
I just want to say one thing about the wall. The wall does not only divide Palestinians and Israelis. It actually divides Palestinians and Palestinians. I actually and my family had to leave our house that we lived for 27 years because of the wall. And this is because my dad, now he died, he had to be in Jerusalem to keep getting health services. So we left the house to be on the other side where his pharmacy is and to be in contact with our family, but now we have a problem with the other part of the family who live in the West Bank and are not allowed to come to Jerusalem at all. That's one thing. Whether the wall will fall or not, I'm as many, I think, a bit selfish. I think in my lifetime it will not go down, be torn down. So maybe one day, but one day is very broad. It could be in 1,000 years, it could be in 100 years, it could be, I don't know, maybe tomorrow, impossible.
7:03, we'll take a few more questions and then we'll stop in about 7 or 8 minutes. So if you have the pressing question, work for it. Yes,
yes, my question, first of all, thank you so much for coming. And my question kind of goes back with the military and the superpowers. Obviously, the dehumanization of Palestine.
It is obvious that Israel has the international support for it, and building the wall, as you said, it's not only dividing other peoples. But the thing is, now you want the U.S. to come intervene and imposing the solution or the resolution or anything, not really for you guys to love each other, but just to live together. But do you think with PLO or the main, the Mahmoud Abbas's government accepting all aspects of the PLO roadmap and what Hamas is there resisting? So there is no, I don't see it as a stalemate between Palestinians themselves. Are they like, because PLO wants the peace, Israeli to a degree wants the peace, but Hamas is being obstacle to it. So if you, as Palestinian as and Jews, are not ready to accept peace, what can you accept U.S. to come to you?
Actually, Hamas wasn't the obstacle at the beginning. Hamas being elected democratically.
Mm-hmm. Well, but democratically, I understand that. But because people were frustrated.
It doesn't matter why. They were elected.
They were elected.
Whatever is the outcome. Like Obama now, people are
They were frustrated with Bush. Maybe that's why Barack Obama won. We don't want to get why. It's a fact. Hamas won democratically. End of the story. Now we discuss why this happened. This is another discussion, but we have to respect democracy.
No, of course, I am not going to the aspect of democracy, but I'm saying like when Hamas came into the power, we saw that the international support for Palestine was cut down.
Yeah.
That was a bad downside of it. But here, as I said, I don't want to go to the subject of democracy. Yes. But my question is just how you Palestinians can come together and with Israelis to accept international help to
if you yourself peace. Are not
yes, if you yourself
united.
How much organizations like you have impact on the decision making? Thank you.
So that's for Julia.
Many of you.
Yes, go ahead. No, maybe you can respond to the question. Hamas and Fatah are fighting over power and authority. How can you expect the international community to come and impose or help if the internal Palestinian, intra-Palestinian house is not in order?
Well, I guess that if the international give Hamas the chance to prove themselves as Islamic political parties being elected, who does say they don't want peace? They been elected, like the election for the Palestinian election started after Oslo agreement. This is the result of Oslo agreements. The beginning, Hamas wasn't accepted. Later on, Hamas accept Oslo agreement. So they've been in the same track. But what happenings with the world? It just started in January 2005 when Hamas been elected. After that, the aid started, all of the world boycotting. There is no more aid. Why? You are asking us to be democratic and we've been elected Hamas. Why you are doing that to us? So my comment on that it's been created, the conflict between Hamas, it's an internal created conflict. If the things will be as the same, it won't be like that at the end. And these days, lots of talks in between the two political parties. And I guess sooner they will reach for a solution for that.
Let's cross our heart.
Imposing a solution, imposing a, not the solution, implementing the solution in Palestine, of course you come from outside, as I said before. You're totally right that today it might not be the right moment for it because we're actually now in dispute. But, you know, Hamas, Fatah, clashes, dispute, whatever, it's a very recent thing. And I think the problem is not with that. The problem is with the whole idea of actually finding a solution. But yes, I agree with you completely. If America decides tomorrow to impose, the implementation of 242 to 338, it will not be possible. We will not actually allow it because we have our own internal fighting going up. So we have to solve it first, then we're absolutely ready for it.
The question was, how effective your organizations for Julius?
I think our organizations are not nearly as effective as I would like them to be. But I want to say something about implementation. You know, in Israel, a number of years ago,
it was decided, a law was passed, that there was no more smoking on buses. And I burst out laughing because I said, there's no way, because all Israelis smoke, and there's no way that people are going to stop smoking on buses. I want to tell you, it took maybe a month and everybody stopped smoking. There is no smoking on buses. So if I had been going according to public opinion, I would say, why are we going to pass it? Why are we passing that ridiculous law when nobody is going to do it? Well, what I have seen is that sometimes things are imposed and you think nobody's going to do it, but you know what? It becomes a new reality. We build these realities. And I know that there are many people in Israel who would like peace, but they're afraid. But if it was imposed and if it became a reality, I don't think it would take them very long, probably shorter than it did the smoking, to see that there is a different way we can live our lives.
Let me take last, question one before last, yes.
Okay, each of y'all have spoken about the fact that this conflict stretches over generations and also about the effect that your parents have had on you. And I was just wondering if you've seen any general trends across generations toward feelings more of reconciliation or of enmity? Yeah, there's the question.
I didn't hear the question.
If you, between you and your father and your grandfather, is there a difference in terms of their attitude toward reconciliation and peace with the other, or the opposite?
Personal, of course, right? I mean, my dad is a refugee. He died only in 2007. And I remember clearly having a fight with him about going back to Yafa. I said, Dad, you're a refugee. You have the right to return to Palestine. And this is an individual right set to you by the United Nations. And he said, well, if you want to go back, you go back. But for me, I will stop here. I mean, I cannot go back. So I think it's actually, I cannot say different to the better, or you know, going to the past or to the future. Really, I cannot say that because it differs. I have relatives who are older. They're much more stubborn than me. I'm much more stubborn than my uncle and my dad. Some of my relatives really don't care, to be honest with you. So I really don't have set like an equation for that.
Well, I guess through my work, I see it. I see it in the new generations, how they are thinking and how our grandfathers and mother, they were living. There is reconciliation in that. And also, if you look at it from a religious perspective, in the Bible, it's been mentioned many times, how to reconcile. But and also, there is an example when who slapped the other. I forget it. It's okay.
If somebody slaps you on the face, give him the other face.
Jesus.
Christian. your Christian education helped you. Yes, Julie.
This was before I was born, but I know that before 1948, Israelis, Jews and Palestinians were in contact with one another. There were many friendships. There were many deep friendships. And I know that one of the sad part of my life is that all my children were born after the occupation. So none of my children have ever lived in a country that they weren't an occupier of another country. So while theoretically I know, you know, they listen to me, they hear me, and they know what my dream is, and that's what their dream is, but they've never known it. They've never known something, and I hope that one day they will be able to know something different.
And we'll take the last question.
Okay. I know we talked a lot about mass media and the effect that you were hoping to have on that. I wanted to maybe bring up the idea of this change that's going on in the world of a more participatory media. And your film would be a good example, possibly, of how do you use that and how is that helping this divide where you can't meet on a physical space. So how are you using this new participatory media to have an effect, and if you're not, what are some people in your community that you would like to mention that are? What are some really amazing things going on using this?
So let me get this straight. So your question is that how Palestinians, for example, in Palestine will use kind of the internet as a space to portray their stories and stuff like that. Okay, there have been many workshops in schools and also for college students using like their own personal cameras and like sometimes really very primitive cameras to shoot day-to-day life. And I think many of them finding a way of actually expressing their anger, and it helped. There's kind of a video therapy, whatever kind of way that you actually show your experience in that particular day and show it to the others and allow a discussion about it, so it's not kept in the dark or not discussed. For me, I actually did a short film, 3 minutes long, and that was 3 years ago or something, not 2 years ago, and only a few people saw it in Palestine, and then I put it on YouTube, and in like 2 days, it went up to 5,300. I was very shocked. So yeah, I think that many of us should actually do more, because I think there are people out there who are waiting to see about your daily life thing. And there is this new website also that many Palestinians are starting to use called demotics.com. It's a kind of a citizen wire thing, and many people are actually now kind of sharing the price of a camera to record certain things that might be actually bought by mainstream media agencies.
Maybe because she's the media expert, I'm gonna stop here. Since this is your first presentation, or second, I have done this also in 1989 in a tour, and one of the main things I always insisted on doing after a couple of times was to try and tell the audience, as American audience, what can they do to assist you in your request or in your journey in pursuing peace, dialogue, whatever it is you're looking for. So I guess, what do you really want to say as one very brief word to the audience here, how they can help you? What do you want from them, besides venting your feelings?
Well, before you go out, you can take this with you, and it's really, there's a lot of things written in which way you could help. First of all, as I mentioned, about the tax, it's very important to ask your government where the tax goes. Other things, you should educate yourself about what's going on. Try to dig for the reality. Don't depend on media only. You can write letters to the Congress, to the government, but what I'm thinking, you should wake up from your deep sleep. And if you believe in justice, you have to work for justice.
I just have one, like, I don't know if it's simple or not, but don't, let me think about it. When you see a headline on the news, don't kind of go into a kind of a conclusion that might be actually most of the times it's totally the opposite of what is happening. So if you read a headline that you're not sure of or kind of doesn't make sense to you, just if you're interested and really want to understand, just dig behind that headline and see what's the real story. Because I think that the problem is that many people are repeating the same thing, like with terrorism, that actually some Palestinians believing that they're terrorists now. Like, it doesn't happen that way. Or many people talk about, you know, killer, and then that's it, they're killers. But what's behind that? What's behind that headline? What's behind, you know, the Qassam rockets in Sudarot? What's behind the Apaches on Gaza? What's behind that checkpoint and many people actually dying on checkpoints? What's behind that? What is the personal behind that headline?
Thank you. Julia, last word?
I would say that become an informed public, read and realize that this is a very complex conflict. I will give anybody my card who wants, and you can email me, and I will give you the answer. but I will say, come visit us. Come visit us in Israel, Palestine. Talk to us. Talk to the people. Hear our stories. See how we live. And then take those stories home and try to impact others.
Thank you. Please join me in thanking our guests.